sucker. This is Movie Fighters, the show where I, Matt Wilson, your co-host, and your other co-host, Chris Sims, watch movies and beat them up. And Chris, we're in for it this time.
We put it off as long as we could. We literally could not go one more day without doing a show, and this is the one that we're doing.
David Willis, the creator of the webcomic Short Pact
and Dumbing of Age,
is forcing us to watch Short Circuit 2.
I see this as a betrayal. I have had meals with David Willis. I have broken bread with this man. And he's going to make us watch Short Circuit 2.
It seems cruel.
Very cruel.
And unusual.
And I got to say, this is a shoot, brother. This is legit. Of all the movies that we found out that we were going to have to watch when the Kickstarter came through and the make us watch a movie tier was taken, the one that I wanted to watch the least, the one I've been dreading the most, is Short Circuit 2.
Now, how familiar are you with the Short Circuit series of films, Chris?
That's the thing. I have not seen them in 20 years or more.
I strongly remember watching the first Short Circuit.
I don't remember if the one that made an impression on me was Short Circuit 1 or Short Circuit 2. So when we watch this today, there might be some repressed memories coming back, because there is a scene in one of them, and I think it's in this one, where Johnny Five, the friendly robot with the funny voice, quite obviously for children, is attacked and dismembered while shrieking, "Do not disassemble me." And that shit fucked me up. Nightmares, like crying. Like, look, because we've talked about this before. I don't like scary movies. I don't like horror movies.
Right.
And the reason for that is because I was scared and really bothered by the dumbest things as a child. Like, I was, before I became the gregarious extrovert that I am today, I was a very introspective child, and I was a very sensitive child. And so, like, I would see these things, and I just couldn't stop replaying them over and over in my head. And so the friendly robot being torn apart by evil men, that shit sticks with you.
That's very similar to my Superman 3 lady getting pulled into the computer and turned into a robot moment.
Yeah, yeah. Except that movie rules.
I watched that repeatedly. And actually, like, maybe it shows the key difference between you and me. Because that moment, this Short Circuit moment, fucked you up and made you not want to watch that kind of movie ever again. That Superman 3 moment fascinated me. And made me a horror movie fan for life. But,
well, the weird thing is, like, my favorite movies when I was a kid were the Indiana Jones movies. And, like, Raiders ends with people's heads melting.
Correct.
And I'm fine. Like, yeah. That's fine. I think because even at, like, 6, I was like, they're Nazis. Fuck those guys. But, like, this, again, it's a friendly robot in a PG movie for children with a funny, squeaky voice. Like, and I believe, again, that's the only thing I remember about these movies. It is the one scene. You could ask me anything else about Short Circuit or Short Circuit 2, which I know I have seen probably multiple times as a child, because we had HBO, and what you would do if you were a child in the 80s is you would sit and watch television forever. That's the only thing I can remember that happens. I don't know anything else about the story. You could put $100 on the table and tell me two things about Short Circuit 2, and I could not do it.
Well, let me catch people up on the first Short Circuit, if they don't remember.
We're not gonna watch them both just so we get the full feature. We're not gonna be here for 5 hours.
We are not. The first Short Circuit, by the way, 98 minutes. The second one is 110. How on earth did that happen?
1 hour, 50 minutes long. And it's on Netflix Instant. If you are the kind of deranged maniac who likes to watch these along with us, you can pause Movie Fighters right now and go watch Short Circuit 2.
Now, here's a bad sign from the get-go for Short Circuit 2. The two lead actors from the first Short Circuit, Ali Sheedy and Steve Guttenberg, were like, no, no, we're too good for this sequel.
Which of them played Johnny Five?
Neither one of them. They were two humans. The only human from the first Short Circuit who returns in Short Circuit 2 is Fisher Stevens, who plays an Indian scientist, despite him being a white guy.
I bet that is going to be so refreshing.
Yeah.
I bet it's not going to make us really uncomfortable. I bet it's going to be a laugh riot.
Aren't we going to love this white man wearing Hindu face? I'm sure we will.
Look, I got two words for you, buddy. Ben Kingsley. Fisher Stevens was the Ben Kingsley of summer 1988.
I guess so. But so when did the Gandhi first come movie, out? The first movie ends with Johnny Five on the run from government types because he was built as a prototype U.S. military robot for Cold War purposes. He was built as a war robot. But somehow, during the process of being in a laboratory, he watches TV and develops a whimsical and curious childlike personality. The military wants to get their hands back on him to turn him back into a war robot. Steve Guttenberg, Ali Sheedy, and Fisher Stevens abscond with him and run away and get him away from the army. And they use a duplicate decoy robot to throw off the army and get away with Johnny Five. So that's where we start with Short Circuit 2. Now, somewhere between Short Circuit 1 and Short Circuit 2, Steve Guttenberg and Ali Sheedy gone. They are not around anymore.
It's really difficult for me to imagine a world, and we live in this world, where Steve Guttenberg and Ali Sheedy, they couldn't get them back.
That's a world called 1988.
Where maybe Ali Sheedy.
Like that one year where Steve Guttenberg was the biggest star on Earth.
All right, what we're going to do right now is I'm going to look up Steve Guttenberg on the old IMDb, and I want to see what he was doing during the filming of this movie.
I would suspect he was making like Three Men and a Little Lady or Three Men and a Baby.
Steve Guttenberg did not come up when I searched IMDb for Steve Guttenberg.
Did you spell it with two T's?
I did not.
It's got two T's.
Oh, it's got two T's.
Yep.
Okay. This is going to be good. This is good radio. Here we go. How many police academies were there in 1988? Were there like five police academies in 1988?
Entirely possible.
Oh, well, here it is. That dude was in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 movies in 87.
Okay.
Including Three Men and a Baby, which is arguably his biggest hit.
Three Men and a Baby was 87. All right.
Right. 88, he's still in two. He's in High Spirits and Cocoon the Return, the sequel to Cocoon.
So he would do a Cocoon sequel.
My theory is this. Okay, Cocoon 1 is 85. Short Circuit 1 is 86. I bet it's a contract thing, and he had a prior commitment to Cocoon 2.
I think I would take Cocoon over Short Circuit also, not having seen Cocoon the Return.
You love old people more than you love robots, though. I am very much pro-robot.
I think it's well established that I love robots. I hate annoying robots. But
look, you write a comic about a robot. But it's a very old-timey robot.
That's true.
It's like an old man robot.
I like old things and robots. We've spent entirely too much time on Steve Guttenberg. I want to get two things out of the way before we start watching the movie. Okay. One is the other members of the cast of Short Circuit 2. Guttenberg and Ali Sheedy have been replaced by a bunch of like character actors that we might recognize when we see them, such as Jack Weston. And then Michael McKean. Michael McKean is like the second credited actor
who plays
Lenny. He plays a con man slash toy salesman, Fred Ritter.
Is this going to be another goddamn movie that we watch where toy sales are a key part of the plot?
Absolutely. Oh, and yes, Johnny Five is severely damaged in the course of this movie, so get ready for that.
I hope you are ready to hear me cry.
And I just want to read one quick thing under the reception section of Wikipedia. This is what the New York Times' Vincent Camby said in his review of Short Circuit 2. For anyone over the age of 6, this film is as much fun as wearing wet sneakers.
That's great.
Yeah.
That is a great line.
Evocative. So, Chris, I think we've put it off long enough. We're going to have to pause right now. Watch Short Circuit 2.
For 110 minutes.
We're getting less than a dollar a minute for Short Circuit 2. Jesus. But we're going to do it. We're going to brave it. We're going to watch the movie. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about it. And we are back from watching all 110 long minutes of Short Circuit 2.
That movie is goddamn ridiculous.
It really intensely is.
How did people make this movie?
You had to figure out another way to ask that question.
I did. I didn't want to. No gimmick infringement on this side, brother. But how did this get past the second person?
Well, okay, so there was a question I was asking throughout the movie, and it still blows my mind how nobody asked this question, because the previous film was all about how the army wanted their robot back. This movie, like, they flee to Montana to hide Johnny Five from the army. This movie puts Johnny Five in the middle of quote-unquote New York City.
Canada's greatest city.
Canada's finest city. And have him doing stuff in public constantly.
Yeah. I was confused literally 10 seconds into this movie.
But at no point is the army contacted. At no point does the army show up and say, hey, that's our robot, we want him back.
No governmental officials ever show up. There are two cops, and that's it.
There's a part where Michael McKean tries to go and sell Johnny Five to what seems to be a company that is a government contractor, because they identify Johnny Five as a robot from an army experiment. And still they're not like, hey, that robot's the property of the army. So, you can't sell that. That's not yours.
Well, now, Matt, to be fair, we watched this on Netflix. This is on Netflix streaming. We'll get to whether or not I want people to go watch it later.
Yes.
This is on Netflix streaming. We did not have the DVD. And I believe the DVD has the bonus short film that they did tying it into the rest of the Marvel Universe, where they acknowledge that the army is calling off the search for Johnny Five.
What I like to believe is that the army somehow disbanded between the end of Short Circuit 1 and Short Circuit 2. The army has just ceased to exist.
Here's the funny thing about this movie. It is, as we have said, it is very clearly in Canada. It is ostensibly set in New York City. There are establishing shots of buildings that have the word Canada written on them.
No, there's a scene where Johnny Five is like rolling down the sidewalk in quote-unquote New York City, and behind him there is a building that says, like, you know, First National Bank of Canada on it.
Yeah.
Like,
there's
literally
product placement for Canadian businesses.
For a Canadian pizzeria.
Pizzaville.
And Labatt's Blue.
And everyone's always drinking Labatt's Blue, which makes sense. Michael McKean, actually Canadian.
Correct. He would love the bats.
It makes sense that he would want a Canadian beer. Also, all the taxis have Ontario license plates.
All the cars have Ontario license plates, not just
so
the taxis.
My question is, if you want to get around that, just say the movie is taking place in Canada.
Yeah.
And just, the army can't go across a border.
Right. Have Fisher Stevens, have Ben Javari, selling Johnny Five toys in Canada.
Yeah, because as we all know from Die Hard 3, once you get across the border into Canada, the U.S. government can't touch you.
That's right. There's no extradition treaty with Canada.
No, because you would have had to write the extradition treaty in English and in French, and nobody's going to do that.
Yeah, who would dare?
Nobody's going to take the time.
Who would dare?
So let's talk about how I was confused 10 seconds into this movie.
Okay.
Like we have said, it has been established, Short Circuit 1 is all about Johnny 5, or Number 5, because he's not Johnny 5 until this movie, I don't think.
Until he's Johnny 5 at the very, very end of the first Short Circuit.
Because Ben is surprised when Johnny shows up and declares himself to have given himself a name. The army's looking for this robot. Ben, who is Fisher Stevens, with a
Caucasian gentleman.
with chemically darkened skin.
Yes.
And an hilarious accent. And a funny way of speaking. He mixes up his words sometimes.
So many malapropisms.
He is on the street in, I'm making air quotes that you can't see, Times Square, selling toys to passersby. Matt, what are these toys he is selling?
They are toy versions of Johnny Five.
They are 1 foot tall Number Fives.
Correct.
That appear, by the way, to be completely autonomous. He is not, like, remote controlling them at any point, and they are wandering off and having adventures.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, because he built Johnny Five, so the idea is that he just built little Johnny Fives.
Yeah. And also, incidentally, gave the little ones the laser gun.
Yes.
The shoulder-mounted laser cannon. So that's like the first thing we see that I'm confused by. And I'm like, wait, why is he just on the street with these? He's also homeless, by the way.
Yeah, he was fired from the army.
The government.
From the government for disobeying orders. And one of his toys, the first thing that happens is one of his toys runs away and goes on a little joyride through the mall. And I guess she's the buyer for a toy company, notices this little robot toy and takes it to her boss and is like, hey, we could sell these.
Because they don't want novelties.
Yeah, there's a
scene
where
they want high tech.
We're introduced to Sandy, played by Cynthia Gibb. First thing we see her doing is like trying to show her boss
of
the Bee Gees. The first thing we see her doing is trying to show her boss a hat with hands that clap. And the boss goes, "We're not trying to sell novelties. We don't do novelties. We do high tech. We want high tech by the holidays." So that's when she gets the bright idea to sell this little weird robot toy that is clearly not a novelty. And order 1,000 of them,
which,
from Johnny or from Ben,
which is so weird that they like. But it's weird in a way that I completely buy that this executive at this company just wants high tech. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as it appears to be technology.
Like, yeah,
I completely buy that.
But like, there's this weird blurred line between novelty and technology, right? It's like, basically, I get the impression she's working for like the sharper image. And
Sky Mall. It's all Sky Mall.
It's all Sky Mall.
Do you want the world's best remote control robot?
Here it is.
She's working for Hemmicker Schlemmer.
So she orders these things, and she's telling Ben, like, I want 1,000 of these robots. She goes out to his table on the street.
She goes out to his table on the street, which she knows right where to find him, which means it makes sense because she would have had to walk past him to go to work.
Right.
And then not notice that he had a table full of fully autonomous miniaturized combat robots then?
Until she saw one at the mall.
This is 5 minutes into the movie. And again, I have seen this movie before 20, 25 years ago. Wouldn't it have been a much better plot if someone bought all these little Johnny Fives and used them for evil purposes? Like, if these were like, oh yeah, these are our assassination-sized Johnny Fives.
Yeah.
And then the big Johnny Five had to fight the little Johnny Fives?
That would have been okay.
I mean, look, I say it would have been a better plot because it is a plot, and this movie has simultaneously no plots and 15 plots.
It's true. The first plot is the getting the toys in by the deadline plot. Sandy right. says, I need 1,000 of these by the holidays. Can you do that? Ben says, oh, well, I could have you 1,000 of these toys by October 31st, 1993.
Womp womp.
Womp womp. And Sandy's like, oh no, I gotta have them faster than that. Then, fast-talking Michael McKean, who is, like, selling stolen watches.
He's selling knockoff Rolexes.
Yeah, next
on
to...
On the street.
Next to, like, it's like they're at a convention. It's like they're at a street sales convention.
Look, that's not... I've been to New York. That's not... You've been to New York. That's not entirely... This is not an entirely unbelievable setup.
Well, Ben is set up right next to Michael McKean. They're like sales booths are right next to each other. So Michael McKean, like, hears money. And so he steps over and he's like, yeah, we can get you these. We'll get you these manufactured toot sweet. We'll get you 1,000 by the end of the month. So they have committed to making 1,000 of these toys, even though they definitely don't have the capacity to make them. Now, this raises many questions. The company that Sandy works for certainly knows manufacturers and distributors. It seems like they could license the Johnny Five toy and hire these other companies to make them.
Yeah,
but
this movie is 5 minutes long if Sandy just goes, let's go inside and have a meeting and we'll buy the rights to distribute number fives. Like your toy robot.
That is not what happens. She forces Ben and Michael McKean, whose character's name is Fred, to do all this themselves, to manufacture these robots all by themselves. So Michael
because Michael McKean tells her they can.
Right. So
and then proceeds to outfit a toy-making sweatshop with homeless immigrants.
Yes, he rents a building that is about to be condemned, which we are supposed to believe is right across the street from a giant, huge bank.
A skyscraper.
Yes.
It is like they legit have a skyscraper. And then they do this terrible shot where it's like Ben is all like, oh, this is the office space you got us. This is amazing. I'm not going to do his awful offensive accent. And he's like, this is the office space you got us. This is amazing. And it's like this beautiful modern skyscraper. And Michael McKean's like, no, not that building. It's number 980 across the street. And they turn around, and there is a shot of a two-story, dilapidated, condemned brick warehouse that is clearly in a different city.
Yeah, and that is apparently going to be torn down in a couple months. That's how Michael McKean was able to get it so cheap.
Because they're going to build a skyscraper.
They're
going to
build
condos
there.
And you remember in the 80s when they built all those skyscrapers.
Right.
Like in 1988 when they were just about done with Midtown Manhattan.
Right. So Michael McKean explains that he got a short-term lease because this place is about to be torn down. Meanwhile, we see two criminals, just as Michael McKean is showing this new warehouse to Fisher Stevens, we see these two crooks in another room with a secret staircase trying to dig a hole to the skyscraper across the street where some fancy jewels are being stored. It's the Van Devere collection. They're being stored in a safe deposit box for a showing at a museum.
Yeah, so this movie about a sentient robot, a sentient pacifist military robot that was struck by lightning, gained a soul, which, by the way, a soul is explicit in the text of this movie. Johnny Five is explicitly referred to as having a soul.
Yes.
Multiple times. Including legally and theologically.
Correct.
A judge declares this and a priest declares this.
And the United States government declares it.
Yes.
At the end of the movie, that he is due all rights as a human.
So this movie is actually about a diamond heist.
Well, it's okay, so it's about a toy-making plot and a diamond heist. You know those two plots you remember from all those kids' movies you watched as a child? Making toys by a deadline and diamond heists?
This is something that came up when we watched Santa Claus the Movie, which I think is still the maddest we have ever been at a film that we have watched. I mean, we were pretty mad at, like, King of Fighters.
Yeah.
I was pissed at Santa Claus the Movie. Because it was a movie for children that was largely about the manufacture and distribution of toys. Which, just because kids like toys, doesn't mean that they're interested in the manufacture and distribution thereof. Those are adult problems.
The business of toys.
Here is what is in this movie. Manufacture and distribution of toys and Fisher Stevens getting laid. And then walking around with a cigarette in his mouth, like with his clothes disheveled, talking about having sex.
Yep.
And also horrific violence, but we will get to that.
And Johnny Five joining basically the Latin Kings.
Well, like the Latin Kings, like Broadway division.
Correct.
Because they have a catchy song
that
they sing. So, but like, this is, it's like that scene in Big where they talk about, you know, the toy company is making a robot that transforms into a building. And Tom Hanks, you know, who is a kid, that's the spoiler for Big if you haven't seen it. Tom Hanks is a kid in a grown-up's body. Tom Hanks has to tell these grown-ups whose job it is to make this thing for children that buildings are boring because buildings don't do anything.
Right.
Nobody sat down the people who made Short Circuit 2 and had that conversation. Nobody sat down the Salkins and had that conversation about Santa Claus the Movie. And I hate it. And, like, already we are off to a bad start. But,
right.
But at the same time, you and I are adults, Matt.
I was still bored.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was. But as an adult, I am obsessed with this business plan. The deal that Michael McCann makes with Sandy is that they will deliver 1,000 robot toys, 1,000 toy robots, by mid-October at a price of $50 each. So the gross income for Ben and Michael McCann, and Ben's company, by the way, is named Titanic Toys.
After the ship.
Right.
He says it's after the ship.
Which is weird. Which I think is supposed to be one of the, like, all through the movie, Ben has these hilarious malapropisms and not knowing what words are, which is mirrored by Johnny Five, which I think is really, giving them credit was an attempt to humanize Johnny Five by comparing him to Ben, but I think has the effect of dehumanizing Ben.
Yeah, it makes it's like, hey, this Indian guy don't talk good, just like this robot don't talk good.
Neither one of these is like a real person. it's a robot and an Indian fella.
Even though, like, people who live in India often learn English, like, as one of their first languages. Like, he doesn't know idioms, but he...
Also, Ben has been in America for at least 3 years.
Right.
Working for the government.
Correct.
And is studying for his citizenship test. Now, I'm not saying, like, as a character, like, he shouldn't have an accent or anything, but he has played this as comically inept at communicating for laughs constantly. Where was I on this business plan? Okay, yeah, the total amount of money coming in to Titanic Toys is $50,000. Now, that's a lot of money in 1988 dollars. That's Reagan times, everybody. Yeah. Things are going good.
Those are Reagan bucks.
Those are Reagan dollars. At the same time, they, like, first of all, that's cash on delivery. So they have zero money to actually produce the toys. They have no money for manufacturing. So Michael McKean borrows a giant wad of cash from a mob boss. This is a plot thread that never comes back. We never see that guy again. Michael McKean doesn't even seem particularly worried about being able to pay this mob boss back.
Well, he later he does talk about how he owes people a lot of money, and that's why he tries to sell Johnny Five.
Is it? Was that his motivation? I thought it was just because he found out Johnny Five was worth a ton of money.
Well, he found out that Johnny Five was worth a ton of money, and then he was going to use it in part to pay off the mob boss.
So they borrow enough money.
Did we mention that when he goes to this mob boss, it's in a strip club in this children's movie?
Yeah, to make his backroom deal for financing his startup business. It is in a strip club. There's a stripper in the background. Like, she is clearly visible. Even watching on an iMac in the year 2014 in ostensibly high definition, it is difficult to tell if she is actually clothed or not. I can imagine, like, watching this on a crappy TV in 1990 on HBO, and you're just thinking there's a naked lady in the background.
Of this PG movie.
Of this PG movie.
Where it also sounds like people say the word fuck on no less than three occasions.
Oh, there is definitely a dude who refers to Johnny Five as a motherfucker and is very obviously ADR'd in to say, what is it, funky mother?
Funky mother, yeah.
Funky mother. So, Michael McKean borrows money from this mob boss. He borrows a wad of cash so that he can lease a building in Midtown Manhattan, hire about a dozen employees.
At minimum wage, but that's still quite an expense.
Which also means they're paying taxes.
Correct. They're not. It's not like immigrant workers that they're paying under the table. Michael McKean strictly says minimum wage. Like, we're supposed to believe that they're homeless, I think.
But, yeah, but they are getting... They are supposed to work for minimum wage assembling robot toys. And what I'm getting at here is that it looks like a lot more than $50,000 is going out the door on this deal.
It does, but they're doing all this for the $50,000. Now, what happens immediately after they hire these homeless people to do their work for them, like on the first night, within minutes, honestly, of the homeless people showing up, they've built one robot, and the two criminals that we saw digging the hole to the bank earlier show up in balaclavas with weapons, and they start smashing up the place. All of the people that they just hired run away. And essentially, Ben says, well, we spent all our money, and we don't have anybody to work for us. In fact, this is the actual line. This gives you a good idea of how Ben talks in this movie. Now we are unemployers. Fred's line is, oh, look, we still got all of the robot parts in the van. I can get a new staff together. Ben, but we are having no more money, and now we are having no equipment. To assemble the robots with our naked hands, it would be slower than moles' asses in January.
Do you like that joke?
But that's the kind of, like, level we're having Ben speak at in this movie. Earlier in the movie, Ben mentions that he's going to contact his friends in Montana, Ali Sheedy and Steve Guttenberg.
He all but says, I am going to write a letter to Ali Sheedy and Steve Guttenberg and let them know what's up.
Yeah. And then maybe, 15 to 20 minutes into the movie, Johnny Five shows up in a crate.
It is such a long time.
He shows up in a crate in front of the condemned building. The crate starts moving on its own. It jumps up, and then Johnny Five bursts through the crate, having arrived from Montana, because clearly Steve Guttenberg and Ali Sheedy thought it was a great idea to send Johnny Five to Ben to have him make his robot toys in New York City where clearly the army's not going to ever find him or want him back.
Now, quick question, Matt. Is anyone worried about someone noticing or seeing Johnny Five at all?
Not even kind of.
Oh, by the way, just a heads up. It is 17 minutes, 20 seconds into this movie that Johnny Five shows up.
Okay.
That's when the crate shows up. It's about another minute before you see the fucking robot.
Yeah. So the only explanation for what Johnny Five's deal is that this, like, after Johnny Five shows up at the warehouse, Fred asks, I thought this was the robot that malfunctioned that we were making little toy models of. And Ben says, what actually happened was we were working on him one day, and suddenly he is struck by lightning. And from this moment on, he's having a mind of his own. So the government tried to destroy him, and he ran away. So now he's living with my friend in Montana in a cabin in the woods, incognito. There's apparently no need for being incognito anymore.
The only thing they're worried about is that Johnny will go out into the city and cause a little bit of a ruckus. Johnny is like a heroin addict, and he is jonesing for that input. He needs that sweet, sweet input.
He loves him some input. We get to see all of Johnny's new improvements to himself. He has put Greenpeace stickers on his body. He has 500 megabytes of memory.
Hilarious!
Wow.
To be fair, that was like better. That is, like, better than the hard drive on the PC that I had, like, 5 years after this movie, so...
He's got a multi-frequency remote control that he can use to control any electronic device.
Literally any machine.
He has replaced his laser gun with a toolbox full of, like, Inspector Gadget tools.
A toolbox that is shown several times to be empty. But contains an umbrella, a Polaroid Instamatic, a fucking hang glider.
Yes.
And there's got to be something else in there.
And he's also added a Nike swoosh to his body. Ben tells him, okay, we can make these toys now. Johnny Five, get to work on the toys. So Johnny Five, not as quickly as you might think he should, but with reasonable speed, assembles a toy. He makes toys throughout the night, but this is the only time we actually see him making toys.
The next time we see any of these toys is when they are loading them into a truck and going, that's all 1,000 of these toys ready to go.
When did Johnny Five make them? Because as far as we know, he spent one night working on them, and I think he said he had made like 60.
Now, Matt. That is the driving force of this movie, right? For the first 20 minutes of this movie, which is a not insignificant amount of time, for the first 20 minutes of this movie, the plot has entirely been about making these 1,000 toy robots and selling them to the toy company. About how much time would you say is left in this movie when they deliver the 1,000 toy robots?
Maybe 20 minutes. Well, oh, no, there's, no, it's there's gotta more, be than, more that. Than that. There's got to be like 40 minutes left.
There's got to be 40 or 45 minutes left in this movie when they complete the plot that is introduced in the first act.
Yeah.
That is sloppy movie making.
Very that sloppy.
That does not bespeak of an economy of storytelling that I would like to see in my film choices.
Okay, so speaking of not having an economy of storytelling, there's... several scenes that occur after this that are totally unnecessary to the movie, but they happen anyway.
All of them. All of these scenes are unnecessary to the movie.
Well, this one is fairly necessary to the movie, I guess. The two criminals who we saw earlier watch through the window as Johnny Five is building the toys, and they're like, oh, we're going to use this robot. They're building toys with this robot. We got to get this robot to work for us. That happens. Johnny Five leaves the warehouse one afternoon. That's where we see all the Canada stuff in the background. And as he's doing this, he meets the gang that I was calling the Latin Kings. They're actually called Los Locos.
And we know that because they have a cheer.
They have a cheer.
that is Los Locos kick your ass.
Los Locos kick your face.
Kick your face.
Los Locos kick your balls into outer space.
Into outer space. And they sing this into the camera.
Yeah. And then later Johnny Five sings it to Ben and Fred.
And I have vague memories of this being like a thing kids would say. The little Los Locos cheer. Yeah. Do you remember that? I
not really.
Vaguely remember that.
I don't really remember it at all.
The scene where Johnny meets the Los Locos is close to being, I mean, it is, if not for the last 10 minutes of this movie, would be my favorite scene in the movie. If only because, well, I guess there's two things that I really like. One, the Los Locos, or in Spanish, Los Locos, are wearing monogrammed leather vests that have their names. And the two that we can actually see are Bones and Spooky. And I think Spooky is the greatest name for a, like, hardcore New York City street gang member. Also, these guys look to be mid-30s at least.
Oh, yeah.
There's one dude who has a super receding hairline. Oh. It is hilarious.
Okay, so IMDb has all four of their names.
Oh, please hit me.
Bones. Zorro.
Oh, that's right, because he tags... I was wondering why Johnny was walking around with Zorro written on him.
Yeah. Lil Man and Spooky.
Lil Man?
Yeah.
Amazing. The other great thing about it is that they see Johnny, and then, like, it cuts to their... Like, they react, and then it cuts back to Johnny, and he's like, hey, you guys trying to get in that car? And then it cuts back, and one of them is just swinging around nunchucks. It is amazing.
So they get Johnny Five to steal 60 car radios, and that is the end of that scene. Like, Johnny just returns to the warehouse saying that he stole 60 car radios, and Ben just has to go like, you can't do that. And that is it. As that is happening, a bank teller from across the street, Oscar, shows up with Johnny Five to say, like, oh, I found your robot. I had to help him cross the street. What kind of business you guys got going on here? It looks like you're building toys. It looks like a really cool operation. You should join the local business association. I have the paperwork for you. So he, like, tries to get them to fill out paperwork, which I guess we'll find out is somehow important later. What happens next? There's stuff about Ben and his citizenship test. There's stuff about how Johnny Five... Okay, at some point, Ben drops that Johnny Five is worth $11 million. I think it's something where the bank teller, Oscar, is like, that robot's got to be worth $5 million. And Ben goes, well, actually, it's $11 million.
Well, there's an exact figure, too.
Yeah, it's 11 million, 2076 and 17 cents. And Fred hears that and he goes, 11 million bucks! So he takes Johnny to a business and tries to sell it to 80s business people. And Johnny gets out of that situation by falling out of a window and hang gliding to a park.
Well, there is a thoroughly bananas scene involved. Like, this whole thing is weird because when Johnny realizes that Fred, Michael McKean, is trying to sell him, Johnny flips out and starts talking about slavery.
Yes.
And how Johnny is a sentient creature and if he is owned by another person, that is slavery, which, again, is a really heavy topic. And then there's an 80s businessman and an 80s businesswoman, and the woman goes, just what we need, a robot who's into equal rights. And then she kind of, like, gets this weird look on her face. And I don't know if that is supposed to be... I don't know if she's, like, realizing that equal rights are a good thing? Or if, like, I don't understand, because we never see these people again.
There is limited context for that scene.
And then Johnny jumps out a window and cracks some jokes on his way down and then sprouts a fucking hang glider. And okay. I was disgusted.
Before that scene where he goes to the business people, there's a scene where he goes to the world's largest bookstore and reads every book in there. Some cops come into the bookstore after them because they're causing such a huge disturbance. There's a cut to where Johnny Five and Michael McKean are back out on the street as if they eluded the cops. How did they get out there? How did they avoid the cops in the bookstore?
And they leave with books.
Yeah,
and
they have.
Michael McKean's like, didn't I get you your books? Which means that like they went through the line
and bought them, even though they were about to get arrested by the police for destroying a giant bookstore.
Okay, there's two things we need to cover. One, there is a romance subplot that is building all this time between Ben and Sandy. And Sandy could give a shit. She just wants her toys.
She just wants them to be delivered on time.
But Ben is head over heels for her to the point where he is not even... He's speaking even worse than he already was.
The one line of his that I actually genuinely like, he says during like a stuttering to Sandy scene, where he says, she calls him by his last name, which is spelled Jarvey, right? But he says it Javari. So she tries to say his name and he goes, no, call me Ben. Or my name is B-E-N. It's spelled Ben. Which I think is kind of clever funny.
I mean, look, I miss old-style special effects. Like, I am old enough to kind of miss them while acknowledging that they are largely terrible. Like, CGI can be terrible in a different way. But those old practical effects, I miss them. But boy, when Johnny Five hang glides out of the office building, there is an amazing, like, matte composite where he is completely translucent, and you can see the entire background through him.
Correct.
It's really bad.
Yes.
Which is weird, because Johnny's real. Like, they have a 5.5-foot tall robot, like, animatronic robot that's very expressive. I mean, this movie is technically impressive? Question mark?
Well, the puppetry is good.
Yeah, like, I mean, that Johnny exists is a pretty amazing feat. But everything else in this movie looks terrible. Especially when Johnny has to, do anything.
When he hang glides, it's particularly bad.
Yes.
So after he hang glides, he decides that he's got to blend in the city, and he can't trust Fred anymore. So he gets some human clothes off of racks just on the sidewalk, and he puts on a trench coat and like a goofy knit cap.
He looks like Mike Nesmith from the Monkees.
He does. And he starts rolling down the street trying to blend in. People start laughing at him. People don't believe that he's a person. Clearly.
By the way, guys, we're not halfway through the movie yet.
Not even close.
We've got over an hour of this movie left to talk about.
So he gets taken in by the police. He gets taken to the police's stolen goods warehouse. Oh,
he also goes into a church in this scene.
He does. He goes into a church.
Confession.
He goes into a church. He goes into a confessional and starts talking to a priest. And there's a gag where the priest starts like trying to tell him, like, he starts saying to the priest, like, I don't feel like I'm as good as other people. In his robot way. And the priest is like, you shouldn't believe that. You got to think of yourself as good as anybody else. We're all human. And then Johnny's like, no, I'm not human. I'm a robot. Oh, he also tells Johnny he has a soul. He says the reason you matter is because of your soul.
Right.
And Johnny's like, oh, I'm a robot. And he makes Johnny leave convinced that someone is remotely controlling him and talking through him because they're scared to go to a confessional?
Yeah. Which, I don't buy that this guy is a priest either.
He's wearing the weirdest priest costume.
Go, I'm not going to say go watch this movie, but if you do, jump to like 48 minutes in and just look at what this dude is wearing. It is a man-sized doily. There is, I am not Catholic. I have not been to a church in quite some time. There is no way this is what priests wear. There is no possible way. One of the movie's three or four really funny jokes is in this scene where there's a running gag about Johnny where Johnny will list off synonyms of things or examples of things, and he always does three at a time because that's funny, right? Like, we all know about the rule of three, right, Matt? You write jokes, you know.
Correct.
The priest says something about like it being like, you know, oh, but you just need to have faith, or he says something about religion or something about the soul, maybe. And Johnny's like, oh, right, religious knowledge, the Bible, the Quran, the Upanishads. And the priest just goes, yeah, but I kind of lean towards the Bible myself, which I think is a really funny gag.
Yeah, there are weird like little moments of subtlety in this movie. Like, I think, like, my name's B-E-N, I spell it Ben, is like funny in a way that the rest of this movie just isn't. It's very strange. I don't know if it's Brent Maddock or S.S. Wilson that had those flashes of genius while writing this, but
I think S.S. Wilson was the boat this movie bought for Michael McKean.
So, okay. Ben goes and picks up Johnny Five from the police impound and gets
because they don't
mad.
Put him in jail because the desk sergeant is like, don't put him in the cells with the crooks. They're the scum of the earth, but at least they're people.
Yeah.
Which is really robo-racist.
So this whole thing is only there to introduce the two police officers who were hanging out for the last half hour of the movie.
Right, because there's a lot of stuff that happens in the scene that looks significant, but isn't.
Is not.
Like, the two books that Johnny got from the bookstore with Michael McKean that he reads while he's locked up are Pinocchio and Frankenstein, right. Which you think like, oh, that's going to come back. Like, Johnny's going to be like, what am I? Am I a monster? Am I someone who wants to be a real boy? And like the next scene is like Johnny and Ben having a heart to heart as they walk along the docks of New York City. But that like, that doesn't really matter. Like, that stuff is never referenced or brought up.
I mean, other than like this, I guess this kind of unspoken thing where Johnny is realizing he's an automaton with a soul.
I guess?
It's very strange.
It's super weird. And again, this is a movie for tiny babies.
Yeah. Who would definitely not get the Frankenstein and Pinocchio thing.
Maybe Pinocchio. Maybe Pinocchio. That was Disney. There's something that happens in this area of the movie that makes me really fucking angry, and that's when Johnny gets arrested. These two cops, they each pull out their handcuffs, and they handcuff one of Johnny's hands, which, by the way, are robot hands that, like, could not be handcuffed because of the way they're built. But then they don't handcuff, like, they use two separate handcuffs for his hands, and they don't handcuff those to anything. Like, you can clearly see one cop just holding the other end of the handcuff as they take Johnny off to jail. Oh, I hate it.
So there's a big reveal that occurs right around here, and that is that Oscar the bank guy is in cahoots with the two crooks, and they're all trying to steal the Vandeveer collection jewels. So all this stuff that Oscar's been doing to ingratiate himself with Fred and Ben and Johnny Five has been just a way to get in with get in with them and get to where they can rob the bank. So they come up, they hatch a plan where they're going to kidnap Ben and Fred and put them in the freezer of a Chinese restaurant. Now, should we talk about the date scene before we get into this, I guess?
The date scene happens before the kidnapping.
Just before. There's a date scene where Ben and Sandy, Johnny literally stops
the date
a
scene
bus.
Reveals that Johnny and Ben are fucking sociopaths, yeah. Is what the date scene does.
Johnny uses his remote control that can be used on anything to stop a bus.
He causes Sandy's bus to break down, which also means they know what bus Sandy's on, and that's creepy.
Yes. So they break down that bus. Sandy gets off the bus. Ben acts like he's just walking by casually. He says, hey, why don't we get some dinner? And they do that. Then Johnny Five takes over a big sign on the street that and starts putting messages on it for Ben to say. Now, the gag here is that he's supposed to be feeding Ben good lines before things start going haywire and his signal gets messed up by a cat or there's a guy with balloons standing in front of the sign or whatever. The problem is the messages he's sending Ben are terrible.
It's the last two people in a 98-person game of telephone.
Yes.
It is a robot who does not really understand communication and being human feeding Cyrano lines to a person who is not good at communicating and only has a vague grasp of the language.
Correct. And so even when he's supposed to be saying, like, the good stuff, it's terrible. So the gag of, like, it messing up doesn't really matter. And it's only when it's revealed that it's, like, Ben has to, like, reveal the truth and say, like, oh, my friend's been putting words up on the big sign over there for me to say. That Sandy's like, oh, that's sweet. Which, yeah. No, it's not. It's weird, and you should Sandy be freaked out. Sandy also doesn't
go, wait, how did you know I would be here purely by coincidence when that bus broke down?
Yeah.
Next to that sign.
Clearly, you set all this up.
Yeah, you're a fucking maniac. You're going to murder me, what Sandy should have said.
And can we talk about that? How long that scene is?
I just checked, and it is 6.5 minutes
long. It goes on for fucking ever. And it could be cut out of the movie completely. You could just show a scene where Ben and Sandy go on a date and revel in their love of like classic like 50s rock.
Yeah, because that doesn't include the scene where then they go to the coffee shop and they're quizzing each other on when these doo-wop songs from the 50s came out, like Bill Haley and the Comets songs. Right. But that scene is integral to the plot because it sets up the next stupidest thing that happens in the movie.
Yeah, okay, so the crooks, Oscar and the two other criminals, plan to have Fred and Ben thrown into the freezer at a Chinese restaurant, while Oscar gets Johnny to cut a hole into the bank vault so he can steal the jewels, right? So all this is happening, and Johnny gets tricked, as he always does, into opening the bank vault. Oscar gets the jewels very easily, and that part takes forever to happen, but that's what happens there. At the Chinese restaurant, Ben and Fred are trying to figure out how to get out of this place. They can't really figure it out.
They've been locked in the freezer, and in one of something that I genuinely appreciate, they have a scene where the two crooks actually break the inside handle off the freezer door. Because normally when this shit happens in movies or TV shows, when somebody gets locked in the old freezer, they're just like, oh, there's no handle on the inside of this freezer that can kill you if you get locked into it.
Right.
They actually show them breaking off the handle and imprisoning them, which, again, that's a small touch in this otherwise ridiculously stupid movie that I do appreciate.
Ben and Fred figure out where they are by looking on the top of a crate that had a squid in it. They see the address of the restaurant where they are. So they're like, okay, great. Now how do we get this information to somebody who can help us? Somehow Ben notices that there's a phone line inside the freezer. I don't know why there would be a phone line in there.
There's like an electronics access panel in the freezer, right? Like you do.
Right.
And I wish people could see me. I am like covering my face right now in sheer frustration with this goddamn movie.
So he's like, if only I had a phone, I could hook it up to this phone line. And Fred's like, well, you're a scientist. Rig something together. So he takes like a calculator and some kind of transmitting like portable radio. I don't know what that thing is.
It looks like the goddamn sonic screwdriver.
That's what it looks like.
He's supposed to be hooking up.
So he hooks this all up, gets it together, and they're like, okay, we can call 911 and message them our situation with Morse code. But it turns out neither one of them knows Morse code.
Another really great line that I am convinced Michael McKean improvised, where he says, what kind of scientist are you that you don't know Morse code?
So they figure out that they don't know how to do that, so they can't figure things out that way. So instead, they call Sandy, and Ben leaves. He starts playing songs on the calculator keypad.
This is goddamn infuriating.
They figure out the tunes to songs through the beeps on the keypad.
Right.
So Ben starts playing songs. So the first one is Help Me Rhonda, because they want to show that they have help, or they need help.
Right. Then they would play Help. But they obviously could not get the rights to use Help.
Well, Help Me Rhonda, I guess, is more of a doo-wop song. I have no idea.
Well, yeah, because nobody would recognize Help.
Right. So then they start playing On Broadway. Then they start playing Downtown. Then they start playing some song with 16 candles.
Yeah.
They're giving her directions to where they are.
They give her directions from her apartment to the restaurant, which in a time when they could not use Google Maps is actually very impressive.
Right.
That they reverse engineered it. So there's this, again, super long scene of Sandy in the cab rewinding and playing her answering machine tape for a cabbie trying to identify the songs.
As if she wouldn't have already figured out the songs the first time she listened to the tape.
It's super weird that she gets it, because it was only established two scenes ago that she is really into doo-wop music. And by the way, when I say two scenes ago, I mean an hour into this movie.
Correct.
They have their date. It is like well into this movie. And that she would hear these and go, oh yeah, Help Me Rhonda, Broadway, Downtown. Like, that's like that she wouldn't just delete that tape is an amazing leap. Yeah,
well, she immediately somehow recognizes that she got a call, that this call was from Ben.
Yes.
When she's like, what goof is calling my phone and playing Help Me Rhonda on the
keypad? They should have named her Rhonda.
They should have.
I would buy this more if her name was Rhonda.
Either way, Ben and Fred get saved from the freezer.
Oh, we didn't say what the last thing is. We didn't say what the last song is, because they're driving around and they're like, oh, what is, you know, this is the last song on the tape. Where is it? And the song they're playing is Doo-Wah Diddy.
Yeah.
Which is fortunate, because where are they, Matt?
They're at Doo-Wah Chinese Restaurant.
Fuck this movie. Fuck this garbage movie.
They get saved from the freezer with, like, comedy ice on their beards and in their hair. Meanwhile, Johnny Five has kind of figured out Oscar's intentions to steal the jewels. And decides that, you know, oh no, you can't steal. I stole all those radios from those cars, but you can't steal, Oscar. So I'm going to, like, chase after you and try to make you stop. So he starts chasing after Oscar and the two crooks now that they have the jewels. And this is the part of the movie where, like, in broad daylight out in the street, Johnny gets violently and horrifically demolished.
Yeah, this is... there's so much about this scene. First of all, there are two men running down well-lit, populated Toronto/Midtown Manhattan streets with a fucking fire axe and a crowbar. And nobody... And look, I know it's New York in 88, but nobody goes, hey, we should let a cop know about that.
Right.
But yeah, when they eventually when they eventually attack Johnny, it's horrific. Largely because it has been established earlier in the film that Johnny feels pain. And that, it's a fucking nightmare, dude. I vividly remembered it. And it is as bad as I remember.
Yeah, it's rough. I mean, his eye gets, like, really fucked up and looks like a human eye. They jab
his eye and, like, pry his eye out of his head.
Yeah.
They chop his arm off with an axe.
Yes.
There's a scene where, and the thing is, like, the thing that makes it even worse, one of the crooks is very bland. Like, which I like, because he's, like, he is so done with this. Like, in the scene where they're pretending to be scared, he literally just goes, "Oh, shit, I'm scared." But the other one, and we remarked on this very early in the movie, he's going for it. He is, like, emoting as hard as he can. And his reaction, because, like, he realizes what they're doing. Like, there's a moment, and you can see it. It's actually some pretty great acting from this dude. But there's, like, a moment where he realizes Johnny is a person and they're hacking him to death with axes in the middle of the street, and he, like, his reaction makes it feel so real.
Yeah.
But and there's a scene where they, like, swing the axe on Johnny, and, like, there is a red liquid that sprays out from this axe wound. And it's battery fluid, as they clarify 15 times in this movie, just to make sure they get that PG rating. PG, not PG-13. PG. You could say shit in a PG movie in 88, by the way. And it's terrifying. It is. If you don't want to watch Short Circuit 2, I do not blame you. But if you want to know exactly what this scene is like, go watch RoboCop, because it is the exact scene where Clarence Boddicker and his men kill Alex Murphy, but with a robot that is, like, to the hand getting fucked up. It is that scene. It's fucking terrifying.
So,
and no one comes to help him. They're on the street where there are people, and no one comes to help him. I fucking hate this movie.
The only way that Johnny manages to kind of save himself is he uses his remote control that can be used on anything to take control of some remote control airplanes, and one of the airplanes rams one of the crooks in the butt, and they have to run away.
Yeah, and then Johnny gets up and is, like, going down the street with his fucking eye hanging out. It is, like, look, I hate Johnny Five. Fucking can't stand them. But, like, this movie for little kids, it's like, imagine that Shrek was savagely beaten in the second act of Shrek and was, like, had his eyeball hanging out. It's so fucking horrifying.
We see a timer that shows that he's only got 2 hours to live, basically. Like, his memory is going to be erased after 2 hours, because his power has been severed.
Also, in this scene, Johnny is begging them not to disassemble him. One of the first thing he does is go, "Oh yeah, disassemble means kill."
Correct.
Like, very early in the movie,
he's, like, hobbling, but he, like, gets a diehard battery and connects it to himself so he can hobble back to the warehouse. The only person who is back at the warehouse is Fred, because Ben and Sandy have been caught by the police for being suspects in stealing the Van de Veer collection. Which is, clearly they didn't do it, but they are being caught for it. They're being accused of this. So Fred is the only one who's there. So they have to – Johnny Five comes back. He can't talk at this point.
He can't talk because they fucked him up so bad that he can't talk. The one thing that humanizes him, they have taken away from him. And so Fred's like, "Oh my god, what'd they do to you?" And Johnny picks up a piece of, like, brick and writes the word "dying" on the wall.
Yeah.
It's fucking bananas, dude.
And he's like, "Dying, need your help." And Fred's like, "What? Where are we going to go? How am I going to help you?" And they turn around, and there's a Radio Shack.
And that was when I went right back to hating this movie.
It's the Radio Shack that's owned by Manic Mike, who we saw in some commercials earlier in the movie, and that Johnny Five emulated for a while. So they go into this Radio Shack. Fred manages to get Johnny Five's voice working again, and then he just bandages up Johnny Five's battery so that as like a stopgap way to keep him alive for a while.
I don't think the problem is that Johnny is bleeding so much as his battery's all fucked up. So, like, just wrapping his sleeve around Johnny's wound does nothing.
Well, he's leaking his precious battery fluid.
Right,
that he
which
needs.
Is batteries are made of fluid.
Correct.
That looks just like blood.
Correct. Battery acid looks exactly like blood, and it's called fluid.
There is a very tense scene that, again, goes on for several minutes of Michael McKean fixing Johnny in Radio Shack.
Yes, and then Johnny discovers that the criminals had just kidnapped Fred and Ben, but tried to kill him. He is enraged by this.
He is so pissed. It is such a weird motivation. It is so weird because he is literally like, "Oh, so they'll imprison you, but they'll kill me. They are robo-racists and they must die."
So he makes himself a mohawk out of stuff in Radio Shack and puts like – he makes himself into a character from the fucking Road Warrior.
Yeah, he gives himself like spikes on his shoulders and like a weird earring thing and a bandolier of fucking AA batteries.
And he charges out to go murder these criminals. You know, the war robot who learned peace is now going to go murder people.
Yeah, the robot that was made for war that gained sentience and rejected killing is now on a fucking I'll spit on your grave revenge movie trip.
Yes. So they go charging out of the Radio Shack. Manic Mike shows up and just as they're leaving and is like, "Hey, what are you guys doing?" The cops show up. This part is a fucking mess. The cops show up and they're like, "Well, Manic Mike is trying to report a robbery." Fisher Stevens and Sandy, Ben and Sandy are there, and they're like, "No, no, no, what's going on with Johnny Five chasing these criminals is more important." So they get the police to leave. So there's Johnny Five and Michael McKean. Michael McKean is riding Johnny Five like a Segway at this point.
It looks exactly like a Segway, which is hilarious. It's like for a brief shining moment, it looks like Joe Bluth is in this movie.
And Johnny Five has some kind of like filter on his eye where he can see tire tracks. So he's following the criminal's tire tracks. Somehow he can tell the difference between those tire tracks and other tire tracks.
Well, Matt, it's the 1988 Chrysler LeBaron.
A late model. So the cops with Ben and Sandy also in tow are following them. Johnny Five decides that the fastest way to pursue the criminals is to go into the sewer. So there's a whole thing where he's going through the sewer and Michael McKean is complaining about how he's stepping in shit.
Yeah, this whole thing makes no sense because, I mean, it would maybe make sense if they were actually in Manhattan and there was traffic. But, like, Johnny Five's top speed is, what, 10, 12 miles an hour?
Possibly.
Like, even when we see him when Michael McKean's riding him and it's very clear that they're being towed, it's, like, no faster than a bicycle. And the car, like, there's no traffic. They're just, like, getting outpaced by the car. And Johnny Five's like, "Well, I'm going to go down to the fucking sewers and go as the crow flies." I don't think that's how sewers work.
Man.
I don't think the sewers are just open underneath all these buildings.
I also don't think Johnny Five could fit in that manhole.
Oh, no. There's no way he can fit in that manhole because he has giant tank treads and a stabilizing wheel.
Right. Either way, anyway.
So Johnny gets under the car when they're stopped. Gets under because they managed to park directly on top of a manhole. Johnny lifts up the car with his fucking super strength and then uses his magic remote control to attempt to murder three men.
He starts making all the electronic stuff in the car start going off, including the seats. Like, the seats start moving back and forth. Because I guess they're remote controlled in the fancy 1988 Chrysler LeBaron. The wheels start spinning really quickly. Like, the motor starts revving up. Johnny Five puts them back down. The car goes onto a ramp, and the car crashes horribly violently. Everybody in that car should be dead.
The weird thing is, it doesn't even look like a car stunt. It looks like a car crash.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I mean, the car goes kind of up on its side and everything, but it doesn't, like, it's not like fucking Cannonball Run, where it's like, yeah, stuntman, having fun. It's like, oh, that's a car crash.
So the two thugs, the two goons, get, like, wrapped up in a fence and otherwise disposed of. But
first they fight Johnny.
Right.
And they grab a crowbar, which is the previous murder weapon, and they try to attack Johnny. And there's some really terrible scenes of Johnny like, oh, suddenly he can fight. Like, he can fight now. He couldn't fight before.
And yeah, while he's something about his backup reserve power gives him fighting abilities now. And the ability to learn Pig Latin. Because the way that Oscar and the other two crooks fooled Johnny earlier is they talked in Pig Latin, which Johnny didn't understand. Now they're talking in Pig Latin, and Johnny totally gets it.
And he says, he doesn't say, like, Ukfe Uye, which I think he should have, but he says something.
Yeah.
He says something to that effect, which is terrible.
So the other two crooks get disposed of, but Oscar manages to get away because he punches
Oscar slugs Michael McCann in the gut.
Yeah, and he starts running away. He gets in a boat.
And this is where you said Oscar is running away and he is huffing and puffing down the street. Oscar, by the way, has got to be 50, at least 45.
Yeah.
He's middle-aged, bald. I'm going to say push in 280.
Somewhere up there.
280 pounds, out of shape. And we're watching this and you go, oh great, the climax of this movie is a chase scene between a robot and a fat man.
Yes.
And you're right. But then, fucking holding out for a hero,
yep.
My Bonnie Tyler kicks in, and it is suddenly the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
So Johnny Five hooks onto a truck to go, like, try to follow Oscar. Oscar gets a boat, and he's like, ha ha ha, you can't catch me in the water, you can't swim. And he's, like, riding in the boat, but he never goes out into the bay. He stays, like, a few feet away from the shore the whole time. So Johnny Five is, like, going right up next to the boat. He gets to a crane.
And the whole time this is happening, Johnny is pursuing him along the shoreline. And the bum bum ba 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 ba, like, that's happening. There are random explosions happening on Johnny's body.
Yes.
It's fucking amazing. There is a countdown to Johnny's total memory failure, which is a display, I don't know where, labeled time to total memory failure, which I don't know why you would have that on your robot, but it's amazing.
So Johnny Five latches onto a crane, he swings out to the boat, he grabs Oscar, swings further out, the boat goes off.
Tarzan yells.
Yeah, he Tarzan yells. The boat goes flying off. Gliding off with nobody piloting it.
Boating off.
Yeah, I don't know why he didn't just drop the crane directly onto the boat and sink the boat. But instead, he grabs Oscar, pulls him back to the shore, and they both fall, like, collapse onto the side of the shore. Oscar, again, should be totally dead at this point.
Oh, yeah, Oscar should be dead. Instead, he is alive enough. I like to think that he dies right after this. Oscar, they land in a heap. Oscar looks at Johnny Five and goes, what are you, punishment from God?
That is a real line. That is what he actually says.
It's like, I was like, worth it. This entire movie is worth it.
At this point, Johnny Five's got maybe 2 minutes to live. Ben and Sandy drive up with the police. and some paramedics. There's a like they get out of the car. There's a paramedic with a defibrillator. Ben's like, give me that defibrillator. Give me that defibrillator. And the paramedic's like, no, what? Fuck you. Are you crazy? And Ben's like, no, I need it. Charge it up as much as it can go. And the paramedic's like, no, I need this for people. That's a robot. And Ben's like, no, I need it right now.
And I like to imagine that Oscar is just fucking flatlining right next to him.
So one interesting thing about Ben at this point is he loses his accent. Throughout the entire movie, he's been calling Johnny Number Johnny 5. At this point, he just starts calling him flat out Johnny 5. He's like, Johnny 5, you gotta live. Johnny 5, you're gonna make it.
He does actually call him Number Johnny 5, and then he just starts calling him Johnny 5.
Yeah,
because I think it is at this point that he has finally realized / accepted Johnny's personhood.
He calls him Number Johnny 5 again after that, though, so I don't know. But he defibrillates Johnny 5 back to life, even though his countdown to zero has already happened. He should have lost every bit of memory.
Well, it's you got a little bit of time. It's like when your car's on E.
a little bit of time after the zero.
Yeah, and, you like when you unplug a machine and it doesn't have power going to it anymore. You got a couple minutes to like save your work.
You do not have a couple minutes. You have 2 seconds at most.
I'm pretty sure.
Unless you have a battery backup.
No, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. So
also wait, but my question is, why would the battery going dead? Which is what's happening, right?
Yeah, he's lost all his battery fluid.
Why would the battery going dead erase Johnny's memory? That's not how computers work.
His hard drive should totally still be intact. Yeah,
they should just like Ben should be like, oh, we'll just take him home and put a fucking new battery in him, and he'll be like, we'll reboot him. He'll be fine.
He could take out his hard drive and build a whole new fucking robot body and put the personality back in it.
Spoiler, which they do.
Yes, because in the next scene we see that Ben has passed his citizenship test. Well, first of all, we see that they have started a new company that is no longer called Titanic Toys. What is the new name of the company?
It's called Input Inc.
Input Inc. With Johnny 5 as the logo of this presumably national, if not multinational, toy company. Well, how has the Army not fucking noticed this?
Well, to be fair, like, they're probably a regional toy company at this point. They only had $50,000 in startup capital, and that's before expenses.
Their startup capital from a mob boss that all worked out just fine.
Right.
So we see Fred and Sandy.
Fred's got a new suit and a cell phone.
Yeah, Fred and Sandy getting into a limo so they can go see the ceremony where Ben is being sworn in as a U.S. citizen.
Best thing about this ceremony is that everyone's taking the citizenship oath in unison, and no one has an accent.
They're all Canadians.
Because they're just like 40 random-ass Canadians.
Yes. And they're taking the citizenship oath. We see Ben giving the citizenship oath. And then next to him is Johnny 5, who is now completely gold-plated. Plated in solid gold.
He's C-3PO. He looks like C-3PO. A Homo erectus. To us, Johnny 5 to C-3PO. That's basically how it looks.
And we are told by this judge who is swearing everybody in that he is the first robotic United States citizen.
Which I gotta say, dick move. Dick move. Because there's, again, 40 people taking the citizenship oath. That's a big fucking deal. Like, if you're an immigrant, taking your citizenship oath is a big fucking deal. And this judge is like, okay, you're all now citizens, but this guy is a special, super awesome citizen because he's like the first. Like, do that separately. Don't fucking like you don't. If you're in an office and they do like birthdays, and they go, okay, we're gonna have a party. Everybody's birthday in November. Come down and we'll do the party all at once this Friday. They don't go, hey, happy birthday to everybody. Oh, and by the way, Matt. Your birthday is, like, extra fucking special, so you get actual presents.
No, but this is more like, hey, everybody, I'm so glad you had a great birthday, but 3 years ago today, we got this copier, and that's the best.
Oh, that's robo-racist, dude.
So, Johnny Five... Here's my argument about this, though. Johnny Five doesn't need to be naturalized. He should automatically be a citizen because he was born in the United States. The army made him.
That's true. You don't get any more American than being assembled by the army.
He does not need to be naturalized. As soon as it is established that he is sentient, there does not need to be a ceremony. Automatic citizen.
But he has to – well, they have to legally make him a citizen. I don't think Johnny Five should be taking a citizenship test with these other 40 immigrants. Johnny Five should get like – because it is important. It is a very important thing for Johnny Five to become a citizen, right? Like he – theoretically, they called people in and this motherfucker passed the Turing test. A government agency determined Johnny Five was a sentient human being. Right? Artificial intelligence exists.
Yeah, and at no point in this goddamn process, no point in this entire fucking process did the army step and say, hey, that's our fucking robot.
Yeah, but like, look, even if we give him that, okay? He should not be taking a citizenship test with other people. There should be because that shit needs to happen on the White House lawn with Ronald Reagan, I guess. I was about to say Barack Obama. Like, if this movie took place today, the citizenship test would be White House, Rose Garden, Barack Obama declaring a robot citizen.
Okay.
There's not even news people there to cover the first robot citizen of America.
Yeah, nobody issued a press release about this.
Yeah.
So, the last thing that happens, Johnny Five gets really excited about being a citizen. He jumps in the air and says he's alive. Freeze frame. End of movie.
Is this the first movie we have watched that ends on a freeze frame?
It may very well be.
I feel like it is. Because even... Did No Holds Barred end on a freeze frame?
I do not remember.
It might have. It might have. A freeze frame of fucking the dead wrestling promoter.
What are our high points of Short Circuit 2?
It's hard to find a high point.
Holding out for a hero?
Like, that entire sequence is so ridiculous.
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to appreciate it on a just, like, I can't believe this is fucking happening.
Yeah, yeah, like, because I don't think they were going for camp, but boy, did they land in camp.
Yeah, and
they brought fucking s'mores... And hot dogs on sticks, and ghost stories, and merit badges. That's how camp they landed.
Well, look, when you start playing the Jim Steinman written Holding Out for a Hero in a movie, it feels like you gotta know something. You gotta know that, like, you've got something on your hands.
Yeah, yeah, but that song... I guess that song was 4 years old at that point, but that song was a hit.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't think enough time had passed for that song to be ironic.
Perhaps not.
I don't think it's ironic in this movie.
Perhaps not. I do not know. But it is. It does make for, like, a pretty weirdly funny sequence.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, this movie's fucking garbage. But, like, when that was happening, it felt worth it.
Yeah. Okay. So there's that. We talked about the handful of pretty decent jokes.
A couple of decent jokes. Again, I think that Johnny as an object, like that
yeah.
The Johnny Five robot exists, and that it emotes as well as it does.
The animatronics are
actually fairly impressive. Now, I think that they had an easier time succeeding than, say, your Jurassic Park or movies like that use practical effects, because Johnny doesn't have to look like a person.
Right.
And they definitely cheat in terms of, like, or they, like, give him huge eyes and no other facial expressions.
Like, compare it to the puppeteering, the animatronics in the Ninja Turtles movies.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
That is way more of an accomplishment than this.
Right. But I do think that, I mean, I like practical effects. Like, I think they're neat. And that Johnny works as well as he does. And also, I gotta say, Johnny's design is basically Wall-E.
Yeah.
So, they what can we do to make kids like this character? Oh, give him giant eyes that are his entire face.
Now, WALL-E is a 1,000 times better movie, but the design of WALL-E is very similar to Johnny Five.
Yeah, he's even got tank treads.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm not gonna say that WALL-E is a complete fucking ripoff of Short Circuit, but I mean, it is.
All right, is that it for our high points?
Well, everything else in this movie sucks.
Low points. Let's start with Fisher Stevens playing this Indian guy, despite being white. All his dialogue being the worst, and just how generally problematic that character is.
Movies were way more racist in the 80s.
Yep.
Is that just me? Or, no. Or is that a true fact?
It's true. I think okay. It's true. We didn't talk about...
It seems like they stopped being quite so racist, like, all at once. Like, 1991, like, movies were like, hey, we shouldn't stop being so racist, right? Yeah,
I think it's Do the Right Thing. Do the Right Thing made all movies go like, oh, sorry.
But yeah, like, Fisher Stevens is... I mean... I think it's too far to say that he's a bad actor in this movie, because he does a decent enough job with the material, but the material is like A, terrible, and B, offensively racist.
Well, there, like, he plays the same character in the first Short Circuit, and his answer to being asked like, hey, will you play this Indian guy in this movie about a robot should be, no, I'm white.
look, he was 22 when that first movie came out. So, like, you know, you take the work you get.
I suppose.
Especially if it's 1985, and people are just like, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, we don't want to hire an Indian guy to play this Indian guy.
Look, so... Breakfast at Tiffany's is a masterpiece, Matt. Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Mickey
forever.
Mickey Rooney. Okay, so... That's bad. We did not talk about Jack Weston, the actor who plays Oscar, who ends up being the big villain of the movie. Even in the parts where he's like not obviously a bad guy, that actor clearly has no idea what to do with his hands. He is constantly waving his hands around and just, he can't not talk without doing shit with his hands. It's so distracting. It's distracting through the entire movie.
And once you pointed it out, it's all I can see.
Yeah. And it's all he does. I don't get why he has to do it the whole time. And why nobody said, like, hey, just put your hands by your sides. It's fine.
But look, I feel comfortable in saying that director Kenneth Johnson, not a very good director.
Yeah, what else has Kenneth Johnson made? Let's take a look.
Well, he is known as the creator of the V science fiction franchise, as well as the Bionic Woman and the Incredible Hulk TV series that people somehow think is good despite being kind of a huge piece of shit.
Yeah, he created a lot of
TV shows. Matt. In 1997, he wrote and directed the movie Steel.
No shit.
Yes.
Oh.
This motherfucker is a two-time War Rocket or two-time Movie Fighters / Chris and Matt Movie Reviews director.
I didn't do Steel. David Uzumeri did Steel.
I thought you did Steel with us. No, you did Superman 3.
I did Superman 3. Okay. I should have done Steel because of fucking Shaq, but I did not.
That's what it was. Because look, you and I have had enough conversations about Shaq. But yeah. This motherfucker did Steel.
Well, there you go. Like, it is poorly directed. It does a terrible job of making Toronto look like New York, even though plenty of people do it effectively now. There is no way this movie is not Toronto. They don't even make a slight effort to not make this movie look like
they
Toronto.
They didn't have to shoot in front of the building that had Bank of Canada written on it.
Yeah.
On the sign. They in giant metal letters that are clearly visible. They did not have to show Ontario license plates several times.
They didn't have to get pizza from the Toronto pizza chain and drink nothing but Labatt's Blue.
Oh, also, the product placement in this movie.
Mostly for batteries.
there is early on, there is just a shot, like while people are talking, they just cut to a shot of one of the workers putting batteries into a number five model. And it's, what are they? They're Kodak Supra Power, whatever they are.
Yeah.
Obviously, the product placement did not work well because I've never seen those batteries in my life.
Yeah, there's a weird product placement. The one where they just look over and there's a Radio Shack is mind-blowingly stupid. Like, it's just how and why and
that
where.
That shot is like from fucking Wayne's World.
Yes, it is exactly like that.
Except it is played deadly serious.
Like, I'll give Michael McKean credit for, like, being a perfectly acceptable scoundrel in this, but it's clear he's just doing this movie for a paycheck.
Yeah, like, you know, Michael Caine and Jaws 4.
He had done Spinal Tap years before this movie came out, and he's still in this.
Look, well, this is a dark time between, like, Spinal Tap and, like, all the other Christopher Guest movies.
This is just before he joined the cast of Saturday Night Live at age, like, 45 or something like that.
Yeah, which he was not very good on.
Yeah, poor guy. Yeah. Okay, any other, like, particular low points we want to point?
Oh, yeah, the fucking RoboCop murder scene. Every children's movie we watch, we have this problem, which is, who the fuck is this for?
Yeah, the everything about the plots of this movie. Like, who? What kid cares about a toy sales plot? What kid cares about a diamond heist plot? What kid cares about Fisher Stevens trying to hook up with Cynthia Gibb and doing, like, a weird Cyrano de Bergerac thing?
Where they don't kiss until the last scene, but they have clearly fucked.
Yeah. But, like, who cares? Like, what kid cares about that Cyrano de Bergerac stuff?
That scene is maybe the worst thing about this movie. It's, the whole like 6.5 minute Cyrano de Bergerac scene.
Interminable. Let's do final thoughts about Short Circuit 2.
Okay. Yes, Johnny Five is a punishment from God.
That's about all there is to say. This movie is atrocious. David Willis, fuck you.
Fuck you, buddy.
We will be back in 2 weeks with a special episode for Halloween. We're going to be watching a horror movie. We're going to take a little break from our listener suggestions, which we've got three or four of those left. But we're going to take a break and watch a horror movie. So come back in 2 weeks for that. That should be a fun time. Thank you to Michael Kill for our theme music. Thank you to Sean Bogus for designing our website. And thank you for listening to Movie Fighters. And we will see you all again very soon.
This has been a Kaleidos Media production.